Begin here by the two dots in Kufet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah says a zevel shel balabait, the refuse or the dung belongs to the owner, the landowner. Whereas vein lesocher ele yotze min atorno or min kairayim bilvad, but the renter only gets that which comes out of the oven or the stove or the ashes that come about. Which seems strange because if the renter is renting the place, why does the balabait have any rights here? So b'maya skinan, what is the situation exactly? If we're talking about a chatzer, in that you have the house, and then you have the courtyard in front of the house, the way that their houses were built was that you had the living space within the house, and then all the utility was done out in the chatzer. So your ovens, your stoves, your kitchen basically was out in the chatzer, and every house had a little chatzer in front of it. Like places in Yerushalayim, in Shari Chesed, and in Geula, could still see remnants of houses that were built in that similar fashion where the chatzer in front contains the stove or the oven or the basic utilities that the people needed. So here too, if the socher did not only rent the house, but rented the chatzer in front of it, the torei de socher and the animals that are there in the chatzer belong to the renter as well, amai shel balabayit. Why do they belong to the balabayit? Why does the dung belong to the balabayit? Over here, he has both the rights to the chatzer, as well as the animals, or his animals, that are producing the dung that's there. Ela b'chatzer, d'lo agira l'socher. Situation in which the renter does not have the chatzer, v'torei d'maskir, and the shvarim, and the oxen that are there, belong to the landlord. So, now you have a situation which is just the opposite, which is pshita. And that's very simple. If the chatzer was never rented out, and the landlord kept the chatzer, and it's his animals that are in the chatzer. Of course, the dung belongs to the landlord. It says, "Lo tzricha b'chatzer d'maskir v'torei d'atum alma kamuba." It's a situation in which the chatzer belongs to the landlord, and the oxen that show up are oxen from just around. They're wandering around. They come into this area, and these wandering oxen landed in his chatzer. Misayile, the Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina. This supports the position of Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina. Da'ama Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina, chatzero shel adam, konelo shalomi dato. That a chatzer, one's courtyard, has the ability to acquire on his behalf, even though he is not present, even though he isn't there, and may not even be aware of the fact, but his chatzer has the ability to act on his behalf. So what happens here is that the maskir's property is being utilized by these wandering animals. These wandering animals leave their dung in his property. Now, the owners of the animals are mafkir, the dung, because stam glalim, mafkure mafkirinu balim. We assume that owners do not want to keep their animals' dung when they deposit it all over the place. And so, therefore, the assumption is that he can acquire it or take possession of the item. So now, since it is in the mafkir's property, it belongs to him. The question is, why would you have even a havamina to say otherwise? So the question is, what are the socher rights over here? And we'll see that in a second. But let's just assume that the socher needs an ability to exit from his house and to go out. So he does have what's called drisat rego. Does have the ability or easement rights to leave his house through the chatzer. So the socher does have some rights over here. But through the questions, we'll see more clearly what's happening. Meitave. Imamar kol mitziot. Shiavo the tocho hayom tikna li chatzeri. So he says, if any things that show up today inside of my chatzer, I will take possession of them. Lo mar klum. He didn't do anything. This is the owner of a courtyard, and he makes a declaration that my courtyard will acquire any objects that land in it today. It will acquire on my behalf. Doesn't do anything. Meaningless. That's why it's a question on Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina just told us that your chatzer can work on your behalf, even without your knowledge. If we subscribe to this position of Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina, chatzer shel adam koneh lo shelo midato, amai lo amar klum? Why is it not effective when he makes that statement? Here it's even better because he's actually articulating the fact that he wants his chatzer to act on his behalf. Nevertheless, it doesn't work. It says, "Achol ma'eskinan b'chatzer she'ena mishtameret." Speaking about a case where it's a chatzer that is not protected, mishtameret does not mean that it's literally guarded by a human being. It just means that it's a secure location. So things or items that are found in it will remain in there, both because they are fenced off from exiting or leaving the area, as well as people from the outside can't just come in and take whatever they want. Doesn't mean, again, mean it has to be locked. It just simply means that it's a secure location for items that are found inside of it. Iochi ema seifa. Then what are you going to do with the latter half of that braita? Yatsalo shem mitziyah be'ir. If there is some rumor circulating in the city that there is this mitziyah floating around, dvarav kayamim. In that case, his words are effective. So here you have a mitziyah. The way that Rashi describes it over here, it's an injured tzvi, a deer that can no longer move itself around or move at a quick pace, and it lands in his courtyard. So the shem mitziyah yatsa ba'ir, and therefore his chatzer is able to acquire on his behalf. V'ibe chatzer she'ena mishtamaret, but if it's a location that is not secure, ki yatsa lo shem mitziyah ba'ir, my habi. Just because there's this rumor or word circulating that this Tzvi Shavur landed in his field, or that there was some sort of flood from the river and it left a bunch of fish in his chatzer, why does it make it his if it's not mishtamer, if it's not a secure location? Kevan, diatzalo shem mitziyah beir, mivdo dile inche mina. Because once the word gets out that his possession or his property acquired this mitziyah that's on his property, so you can simulate the effect of a secure location, which is that the idea of a secure location is that it's unique to you. The items there will not leave, but also other people from the outside are not going to come in or just take things from there. So here you have a tzvi shavur, you have fish that were washed up, they're not going anywhere. On the other hand, it's open to other people just taking them. But here, people know already, or the word is out, that it's his mitziyah, he found it, it's on his property. And so people walk away from it. Now the truth is that people in general don't walk away from things, and so it's hard to understand that. So there are Rishonim, I think like the Rabbeinu Hananel, who suggest over here that this is a part of a policy that we see in the Gemara and other places, that the government made a claim on all mitziyot. Then anything that was lost was automatically government property. It's akin today to finding antiquities. So the antiquities automatically go to the government. They're not yours just because you found the antiquities. So in their day, any mitziyah belonged to the government, or something along the lines that even if the government didn't take it, they demanded you pay taxes on it. So it was seen to be as a windfall, and therefore they taxed you on the windfall like a lottery winnings that the government taxes at a very high rate because they see that as a windfall. So similar over here, the mitziyah, or the word got out there was a mitziyah, people walked away from it because they didn't want to get into altercations with the government or have the government confiscated or say, why are you taking the mitziyah? So the b'dila inishe mina is not only because the word got out that it was in his property, but also the word got out that it was a mitziyah and it was getting a little too public and they don't want to be involved with it anymore because of the governmental regulations. So for that reason here, we now have a structure in the Gemara which suggests that the chatzer of an individual, as long as it's mishtameret, or it can simulate mishtameret, then it works to acquire on behalf of the owner, because the chatzer, shel adam, is able to work and acquire on his behalf. Assuming it's l'schuto, assuming that it's to his benefit, it can be, even be without his knowledge. So now, in explaining our Mishnah, the Gemara says that it belongs to the maskir. You have these oxen that wandered in, they got through the doorway, they wandered in there, they deposited their dung there. It belongs to the owner of the chatzer because his chatzer is a secure location. The braita that we just brought, in that situation, it does not work for his chatzer, even though he articulates the fact that he wants it to, because it's not a secure location. In the latter part of that braita, even though it's not a secure location, because of the circumstances, it simulates a secure location, and therefore his chatzer is able to acquire on his behalf. It's very different over here. Over here, the dung is something that the stam balim are mafkir. They relinquish ownership. So then your chatzer can work on your behalf to acquire it. By the trees, the owner doesn't want to give up his trees, so then the other person's property can't acquire it on his behalf. Meitevei, zevel ha-yotze min ha-tanur min ha-kirayim. So the refuse that comes out of the oven or out of the stoves, v'kolet min ha-avir, hariu shelo. And anything that comes out of the airspace, v'hariu shelo, it belongs to him. Ushi berefet, u'bishachatzer shabal habayit. On the other hand, the things that belong in the cowshed, or the things in the chatzer, they belong to the balabayit. So now here you have a division of ownership between the two parties, which is that the socher gets anything that comes out of the stove in the oven, and he also gets anything that goes through the airspace of the chatzer. On the other hand, anything that lands in the cowshed or in the chatzer, that belongs to the landlord, Shabalabait. Bim'ita lahad Rav Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina. If we do subscribe to Rav Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina's position, damar chatzero shel adam konelo shelo midato, that the person's property is able to acquire on his behalf, kolet me'avir amai harehu shelo. When something descends from the airspace, why does it belong to the socher? Avir chatzerohu. It is the airspace of the chatzer. If you think about the walls of the chatzer, they create an airspace, which is also the possession of the owner of the chatzer. So as soon as something enters into the airspace of the chatzer, he should be able to acquire it, to take possession of it. Why does the socher have any right? Truth is that Tosfot says here that the Gemara's question is even more problematic, because they're asking, well, Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanin is true, then why doesn't the Avir of the Chatzer successful at a Kinyan? So now the Gemara is going to assume that we don't have Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina. If that's the case, why does the Chatzer of the individual acquire it at all? So the Ramban over here answers that it has to do with the dots of the individual, which is that had we not had the din of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, we would assume whatever the person has in mind would work. So in the case of his chatzer, he would have in mind that his chatzer would acquire things that he would know about or think about or consider being there, foreseen types of situations. But avir, in the airspace of his property, it's clear that he doesn't foresee the airspace acquiring things, and therefore would not acquire on his behalf. The chiddush of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina is that it acquires in the airspace the chatzer, afilu shelo midato. So both the airspace and the chatzer, afilu shelo midato, they can work on his behalf. So that would be the explanation had we not had Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina. But once we have Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, now we have a serious issue, which is, why is there a difference between Avir and Chatzer?
Amar Abaye, so Abaye suggests over here, b'madbi kli b'shulei para.
So to answer your question, akolet me'avir is that the animals are defecating. As they defecate, it's released from the animal, but doesn't hit the ground for a certain period of time. So akolet me'avir means that the socher is capturing the dung before it hits the chatzer. So now he puts a clay, puts some sort of bucket right behind the animal, and the bucket is capturing all the dung that is falling out of it. So now you have a utensil of the socher that's interfering or intervening between the airspace or the chatzer of the Baal HaBayit. So that's why the socher gets to keep it over here. So now the Gemara says, Rava Amar, Avir she'in sofo lanuach, lav kimunach dami. It depends on how you view the airspace over here. Because when it comes to airspace, airspace has the ability to acquire on your behalf if it's going to come to rest in your chatzer. That means that once it enters the airspace, it's yours as long as it will land in your chatzer. But if it's in your airspace, but will never land in your chatzer, that doesn't mean that you take possession of it. And that's what happened over here, which is that the dung was in the airspace, but it didn't come or land in his possession because the socher came out and somehow interfered over here. It says, Umi pshitale the Rava? Is it so simple or straightforward for Rava? V'hami bayi bayi la? Didn't we say earlier on in the Masechta, the Rava actually posed this question. The bayi Rava. Rava queried, Zarak arnaki bepetach zeh, v'yatzta bepetach zeh. Person throws away his wallet, his money pouch. In essence, we're assuming he's being mafkirit, because otherwise, why is he throwing it? But he threw it in such a manner that it went in one entrance to his chatzer and exited the other side of his chatzer. Mahu, what is the din there? So it's clear that it's not going to land in his chatzer, but it's passing through the airspace of his chatzer. Avir, she'ein sofo lanuach, kumunach dami. Airspace where you're not going to land, is that considered to be as if it landed? Olav kimunach dami, or is it not considered as to be if it's landed? This goes towards a machloket that we see in other places. It's not identical, but similar, which is kluta kimisha huncha dami. That when something is in motion, how do you view the motion? Do we view the motion as something in a continuous movement? And therefore, there is no discrete points through this. It's simply a continuous motion. And that means wherever it leaves and lands, those are the only two discrete points. There's a point from where there was an akira, and it left the ground, and then there's an area where it was munach, where it then landed. Everything in between is considered to be a single motion. Or, do we look at it as that along the way, this is the physics question, do we look at it as being discrete points along a continuum? And if that's the case, then you look at it as if there's an akira and hanacha at every moment that it is moving. Or you remember, it has the application by Dinei Shabbat, it has application in other areas. So this is a similar type of question. It's not identical, but it's the same genre of question, which is, here, this thing is going through his property, but will not land in his property. Does his property have the ability to acquire on his behalf because it's in the airspace of his property? But it's airspace that will never terminate its motion within his chatzer. So Rava leaves that as a question. Over here, all of a sudden, Rava makes a declaration that something that's in your chatzer that will not land in your chatzer, your avir doesn't work. Wait, why all of a sudden here is he so certain about that issue? And yet, back earlier in the Masechta, he was querying about this issue. It says, there's a difference. Hatam lo mifsak velo mide. Over there, the problem is that there's nothing stopping the object. I mean that you have two problems or two questions that really arise over here. One of them is the motion that we described now. The second of which is there anyone else who is competing or vying for ownership? So in the case where it flies through the chatzer, you have both the motion question, but there's also no one else vying for ownership. Because during the time that it's in your chatzer, there's nobody else trying to stop it or blocking it or taking possession of it. On the other hand, in our case over here, there's not only the motion issue where it's in the avir of the chatzer, but you also have a socher that is interfering and trying to acquire against your chatzer's ability to acquire. So there, Rava agrees that, first of all, it's in your airspace, will never land in your chatzer, plus someone else is trying to make a kinyan on it. The socher is actively trying to engage with this dung. In that case, Rava agrees that your chatzer has no ability to take possession. In the case early in the Masechta, over there was nobody else vying for the possession of the item while it was in your chatzer. It simply was moving through the chatzer. There he has a question as to whether your chatzer has the ability to acquire on your behalf, even though it will never land in your chatzer. And that's what he says here. Hocha mifsa kli. Over here, the kli interferes and therefore vies for ownership. And that vying for ownership, together with the fact that it will never land in your chatzer, makes it the possession of the socher and not the maskir. It says, u'shiberefet u'pishichatzer. So the Gemara here is asking about the Braita. The Braita seems to duplicate its language, which is that shiberefet shibachatzer, elushel balabait. They both belong to the balabait. And the Gemara is perplexed by why the Braita brought two examples. Why do I need a chatzer and a refet? Tarte, the way Rashi reads it, bitmiya. It's a question. Tarte, it's tricho, the tana, the mitne? Why does the tana have to write both of these items? Litne chado, one of them would be sufficient, since we know that he didn't rent it out. Mali refit, mali chatzer. The case here is where the maskir retained rights. And if he retained rights, what does it matter if it's his cowshed? What does it matter if it's his chatzer? Why give me two examples of the same thing? Tosafot goes one step further, and this is usually the way the word tarte is used in Shas. Tarte means the satran adadi. There are mutually exclusive positions. The high bisharefet lo itzrich the mitne the gufe. You don't need to write about the cowshed, the pshitu. The socher bait bechatzer shein lo berefet klum. That is because it's obvious that when you rent a house, the cowshed doesn't come with it. It's not part and parcel of the rental. Chatzer, there you have a question. Whether it does come along with the rental or not. So now, if it's the case that by the chatzer we say that the maskir keeps the rights, then you don't need to tell me anything about a refet. The fact that you're telling me about a refet already, so you must be that it's for a diyuk. This is what I said before, that by the refet, where the maskir has all rights and the socher has no rights, but that's different than the chatzer where the individual has easement rights to enter and exit through that chatzer. So therefore, lo avi de balabait, v'adatani, sha'ap chatzer de balabait. So the Tosfot says there's a stira here. Because once you write the word refet, Refet seems to indicate the reason that it's the maskirs is because he has full ownership over the refet, implying if he had less than full ownership over the item, he would not get rights. Then you mentioned chatzer, where he doesn't have full rights of ownership, and yet it still belongs to him. So the first refet and the chatzer are satria hadadi. They are contradictory because they present different reasons for why the maskir has rights over here. Rashi's view of the question is simply, just write chatzer, and you would have known refet. It's obvious. Tosfot says that there is an internal stira because the reasoning behind refet would tell me that chatzer does not belong to the maskir. And then you come along afterwards and tell me that the chatzer does belong to the maskir. Amar Abaye, hachi kamar. The answer is, shibarefet shibachatzer, arelu shel balabayit. If it is in the refet that is in the chatzer, then it belongs to the balabayit. So until now we thought that the refet and the chatzer were not rented to the socher, and that was the chiddush of the braita, that it belongs to the maskir in those instances. So we had the problem, which is why do you need refet and chatzer? The Gemara now says we're talking about a refet in a chatzer. But the chatzer is rented out to the socher. And despite the fact that the chatzer is rented out to the socher, he has no rights in the refet. And that leads to Ravashi's conclusion here, which is, so Ravashi, zota merit. From this you would conclude, ha-maskir chatzer stam, lo hiskir refet shibah. That when a person rents out his chatzer, the cowshed doesn't come along with it. Because what the Braita is saying is that a socher has no rights to the cowshed in the chatzer. Even though it's in the chatzer, and yet he still has rights in the chatzer, but no rights to the refet. So Ravashi concludes from that a refet doesn't come with the chatzer. It's considered to be a separate area and doesn't automatically come with the courtyard. Gemara says, Meitave, Yone Shovach, Yone Aliyah. That you have these pigeons, these doves, which are in a dove coat. One of them is Yone Shovach, which are dovecotes out in the field or out in the open areas. Yone Aliyah are those that live in the upper parts of the house, in the top or the roof of the house. Chayavot Bishiluach. One is obligated to do the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein, which is the obligation to shoo away the mother bird in order to take the eggs. Ve'asurot B'gezel. And they are restricted in theft. Mipnei Darchei Shalom. Because of keeping the peace. Once you see that, that means that it's not asur and gezel min haTorah. That means that the person does not have ownership over that. And these go hand in hand. Because shiluach hakein, it says ki karei. That's the beginning of the pasuk that begins the mitzvah of shiluach hakein, which is when you chance upon a bird that is sitting on its efrochim or beitzim, when it's sitting on its chicks or its eggs, you must shoo away the mother bird before you take the eggs or the chicks. That is not true of domesticated animals. Animals that you own, that are in your possession, there's no chiyuv of shiluach hakein. Shiluach hakein only applies if it's not yours. So now you have these birds where they're not yours. They're not yours has two implications. One of which is you are obligated in shiluach hakein. The second of which is someone who steals them from you is not stealing. The only reason it's considered to be theft is midrabanan because of Darchei Shalom. We don't want people going and picking off other people's pigeons, even though they don't belong to him. V'mi'ito l'ha adama Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina. If we do subscribe to that position of Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina, chatzero shel adam koner lo shelo midato, then over here, where the pigeons are in his chatzer, karikan ki karei prat l'mizuman. Then over here, when it says ki karei in the pasuk that you chanced upon a bird, prat l'mizuman, something that is domesticated or readily available to you, over here, this is mizuman. It's in your chatzer. You should own the pigeons that are there. As Rashi here described, the nature of the pigeons are that they fly away. They leave during the day. They go find themselves food. You're not providing them with food. You're not providing them with anything besides a dove coat. And they return to the dove coat at will. So they're not trapped in your chatzer. They are living in your chatzer. They are nesting in your chatzer. But they are not physically being taken care of by you, which is not feeding it. And the Braita is telling us that you don't own them because they are not trapped and they are not beholden to you. They go and get their own food. They take care of themselves. And if they chose to, they could fly away and make their nest somewhere else. So they're not beholden to you. The reason that you rely on them is because most birds, once they make a nest, will come back as long as it's safe and secure. So the assumption of this individual is that these doves will always return to their dove coat. That's why you set up the dove coat, so that they will land there, make a nest, and come back there. but even though they're not in any way yours. So that's what the Mipnei Darchei Shalom is over here, is that since you've set this up and they come back to your property on a regular basis, for someone else to take possession of them would be theft. Midurabanan would be because of Darchei Shalom. Again, you don't own them. But that also makes you obligated in Shluach HaKein. The question is, why isn't your Chatzer able to take possession of them without your knowledge? Or why doesn't it just make it yours? So now we're going to have three different answers to that question. The first of which is Amarava. Beitza bitziat ruba hu dichayev la b'shiluach. Shiluach again already starts, or the obligation starts, once the majority of the egg has exited from the bird. Umikna lokanya adanafla lechatzero. But his chatzer does not acquire on his behalf until the egg is deposited on his property. I mean, once the egg has been laid, then his property takes possession of it. So therefore, the obligation of Shluach HaKein precedes his acquisition or ownership of the egg. B'chid katani chayavot b'shiluach. And therefore, when the Braita says you have to send away or shoo away the mother bird, mekamei d'tipo l'chatzero. It's before it was laid, the egg. It was while the egg was being laid. And so therefore, you have an obligation to shoo away the mother bird in order to take the egg. But it's prior to your ability to take ownership over it. It's a interesting case, because he was going to have to shoo away a mother bird who is more than halfway through laying an egg. So you can't take the egg without shooing away the mother bird. So you're going to shoo away the mother bird before the egg lands in your chatzer. It's an interesting case that Rava suggests. But the Gemara says, Ioki, amai asurot mishum gezel. Why are they restricted in gezel at that point? Your chatzer has yet to take possession of them. They still belong to the birds, meaning the eggs belong to the bird. Where it says, ayiman. The Darchei Shalom, or the Gezel, is with the mothers, meaning that the pigeons or doves that are laying the eggs, that's where it says that they are Esrot Mishom Gezel. To steal the mother themselves would be problematic. The eggs don't belong to you because they have yet to land in your Chatzer. V'ibay Teima, the Olam HaBeitzim. The case here is we're speaking about the Beitzim themselves. Ubedinofik Ruba Date Ilava. That once the roll of the egg exits the bird, even though his Chatzer has yet to take possession of it, he definitely has his mind on that egg. He thinks that egg belongs to him, even though it doesn't yet belong to him. The bird is in a process of laying the egg, and in that moment that it crosses over the rove, but before it's laid and put in the chatzer, there's an obligation of Shluach HaKein. There's also an Iser Gezel that is Midrabanan, because he has his eye on the egg that he's going to keep at that point. So now we have a second possibility, or a second answer. V'hashta namar Rav Yehuda amar Rav. Asur liskot bebeitzim, kol zman she'em rovetzet aleihem. You cannot take possession of an egg while the mother is incubating them, while she is on the eggs. Shene'emar, shaleach tishalach et ha'em, that you must shoo away the mother bird. V'hadar et ha'banim tikach lach. And then afterwards, you're allowed to take possession of the children, the eggs, or the efruchim. So, afilu teima d'nafla l'alechad seiro. Then even then, once it falls into his chatzer, it's not his. If you have the ability to acquire something, then your chatzer can act on your behalf to acquire as well. If you do not have the ability to acquire it, then your chatzer also does not have the ability to acquire on your behalf. So over here, there's a restriction min haTorah for you to take these beitzim. Since they are asur min haTorah for you to take them, you cannot possess the egg without violating an Isur haTorah, which is to take the egg while the mother is on the egg. So that means you are restricted from taking the egg. Since you are restricted from taking possession of the egg, your chatzer also, who's acting on your behalf, is restricted from taking possession of the egg. So then, the obligation to be shaleach et ha'im still exists, because you have yet to take possession of the egg. And so now, when you shoo away the mother bird, then the egg becomes yours, because at that point it becomes mutar for you to take the egg, and your chatzer acquires it on your behalf. Where it says, Yochi, asurot b'gezel, mipnei darchei shalom. If that point, the gezel is not because of darchei shalom, idishalcha, gezel ma'al yehu. Once you send it away, it becomes fully fledged yours, and that's full-fledged gezel. Meaning that, why are we talking about gezel midrabanan? We should be talking about gezel midoraita. You have real ownership over the egg now. Now, if it's before the bird was shooed away, then he has the same restriction that you have. Just like you're restricted from taking the egg, so is the gazlan restricted from taking the egg. It says, Ida lo shalcha, hai ba yishlucha. And if he didn't send it, then he still has to send it, and it's not his, or it's not the gazlan's. The gazlan has the same problem, which is, you have to shoo away the mother bird. Once you shoo away the mother bird, the egg automatically becomes his in his chatzer, and then you're gonna have gezel d'oraita. Gemara says, bikatan, delar ba shiluachu. Talking about a minor who is not obligated in shiluach akein. He doesn't have an obligation because he's not chayav in mitzvot, and therefore he can take possession of an item without shiluach hakein. He doesn't have the interference blocking him from taking possession of the item. You as an adult have a problem, which is the Torah tells you must shoo away the mother bird, and then, only then are you mutar to take it. That means that your possession only happens after shooing it away. For a katan, he does not have the obligation in a Torah to shoo away the mother bird because he's not a bar chiyuva. He's not a party who's obligated. Therefore, he doesn't have that interference between him and the taking possession of the egg because he could take the egg without shooing away the bird. There's no isur for him. There's no obligation for him to do such. Gemara says, katan bar darchei shalom ho? Is the katan subject to darchei shalom? Meaning that, is he someone who's going to get into a fight with someone else? I mean, darchei shalom is to stop people from getting into fights over possession, over property. But over here, the katan, he's not someone who's going to be a bar pluto because of the fact that he is a minor. So why is darchei shalom relevant by him? It says, achikamar, achviv shel katan chayav lagzilo mipnei darchei shalom. Now it's talking about the father of the katan. You have to give it back to him because of darchei shalom. So the situation, the circumstance involves the father, and therefore that's what creates the situation or circumstance of darchei shalom. So if it is a katan that's taking the egg over here, and since he's not obligated in shiluach hakein, therefore he's able to take it without any barrier between him and the egg. There's no violation of an isur that prevents him from taking it. But then the Gemara says, if that's the case, why does the katan have an issue of darchei shalom? A katan is not someone who gets into altercations or has fights with other people. So the answer of the Gemara is that we're speaking about aviv shel katan, that the father of the katan has to return the egg to the bala chatzer because of darchei shalom. And not that the katan himself is obligated, but rather the father of the katan, who's responsible for him, must take action on his behalf to prevent the bala chatzer from getting upset or from it being deemed like theft that the katan took this, even though technically min ha-din, the bala chatzer did not own it, but mipnei darchei shalom, we gave the owner of the chatzer the right to that item, and therefore the father of the katan is responsible to return it to that owner. Tosfot points out, given the fact that we're saying here that the katan took the egg before it was in the chatzer of the bala bayit because there was the necessity for shiluach hakein, Tosfot says you could come up with a similar scenario even by a gadol. If a gadol sticks his beged or his hand under the egg, then shoos away the bird, and then it's in his hand or his beged, and never reaches the chatzer of the bala bayit. And so you could, through a gadol, simulate a similar situation. He says, Tema, why the Gemara didn't do that? Assumption is that the Gemara used a case that was simpler, just that the katan took it, rather than a situation where a person's doing all of this fancy footwork in order to acquire it instead of the chatzer bala bayit when he shoot away the mother bird. Next Mishnah. A maskir bayit the chavero l'shana. Person who rents out a house to his friend for a year. But then, nitabra shana. It turned out to be a leap year. Nitabra l'socher. The renter is the beneficiary because he rented for a year. And a year is from the date he enters till that same date a year later. This year it'll happen to be 13 months instead of 12 months. That's to the benefit of the socher. The Rashba over here wants to limit this to a case where he rents only at the beginning of the year, when he rents in the Tishrei Aleph, because then it's clear that the word shana at that point means an entire year. But if you rent in the middle of a year, then the meaning of shana is less clear. That is Rashba's position over here. The Rimi Gash rejects that position of the Rashba, and says that he couldn't find his Rebbe, the Rif, never said such a thing, and therefore he was unwilling to accept it. And the Halacha, we generally don't accept that position of the Rashba, that the requirement of it being a year, it must be from Tishrei Aleph. No, it could be any time in the year. As long as you say a year means from today until the same date, a year later. And a year later could be 12 months, it could be 13 months. If he rents it, he says, you get it for 12 months, or you get it for a shekel per month. Then the maskir, the landlord, is the beneficiary of the extra month, because the rental is stated in terms of monthly cost. There was an incident in Tzipori. Person rented the bathhouse from his friend for 12 gold coins per year. One gold coin per month. So they have both expressions over here. Both the fact that he's renting it for the year for 12, but also that it's one dinar zahav per month. So the issue was brought before Rabban Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Yossi. Obviously the question was, it was a leap year that happened in the interim. Who has to pay for that month? Does the socher, the renter, get that included in the price? Or does he have to pay for that extra month that he got? V'amru yachloku et chodesh ha'ibur. And they said they should split between them the chodesh ha'ibur, the leap month, which means, or seemingly means, that they have a safek over here, that the safek then leads to their belief that you have to split it. Now, even though generally we say by Rabbi Yossi, we find Rabbi Yossi in Kodoshim who says, and we're going to see this in the Gemara as well, something called tfos lashon rishon or tfos lashon acharon, which is that when people make statements, what do we focus on? Do we focus on their first statement or we focus on their second statement? Do we look at their first statement as being the primary statement? And that's what they say afterwards as explanation, but the first statement is what's koveya. Or do we say that it's the second statement because they're really backing away from the first statement and they want the second statement to be the valid statement? So that's a machloket that we're going to see in the Gemara in 1 second. Rabbi Yossi happens to be of the opinion that the tfos lashon rishon ve'acharon, that both take hold. So the Tosafot over here asks, why doesn't Rabbi Yossi say over here that it is tfos lashon rishon ve'acharon, that they're both effective over here? So he says, ve'yish lamar, tohocha mispekele, over here Rabbi Yossi is in doubt as to whether it's the first language or the second language, because the Achehim Sotrim Ze'etze, they are mutually exclusive positions. Aval Bitmura, in the Din of Kodoshim, She'enan Sotrim Etze, they're not mutually exclusive positions, Am Rabbi Yossi Tfos Lashon Shnehem, that we hold by both languages. Meaning that Rabbi Yossi's position that your entire statement is valid is in a case where you can make the whole statement valid, because there's no in contradiction within the statement. Over here, it's clear that the two parts of the statement contradict each other. Because if you pay 12 zahav for a year, then that's different than paying 1 zahav per chodesh. So if we were to say that both pieces of your language are valid, they are mutually exclusive statements, and therefore you can't make both of them valid. And therefore he has a safek as to whether the first statement or the second statement is valid over here. And that safek is what renders the yachloku in the Mishnah. Amari asks, Ma'aseh listor. He brought an incident in order to upend that which was said in the Mishnah. Now, classically, Ma'aseh listor means that the statement over here comes to undermine the halachot that were brought in the Mishnah. Now, over here, the truth is it does not undermine that which is in the Mishnah, because that which is in the Mishnah had nothing to do with the case. Our Mishnah spoke about a case where it was clear that he rented it for the year, and spoke about a case where it's clear that he rented it by month. Then also we have a case where he made both statements in the rental. So the ma'aseh does not necessarily undermine or soter what it was said before in the Mishnah. So the way the Rashi says is, Tana, o kule de socher, kule de maskir, mighty ma'aseh de yachloku. Rashi just simply says is that the ma'aseh has nothing to do with the cases in the Mishnah. So it's not your classic sense of listor to undermine the halacha that was beforehand, but rather, simply, you're bringing an incident that has nothing to do with the two cases or halachot that you brought in the Mishnah. So that's the way Rashi reads it. It's not necessarily a contradiction. It's simply that the case was not addressed in the Mishnah. So why are you bringing a case law that has nothing to do with that which was addressed in the Mishnah? On the other hand, the Ramban takes it much more literally and says that Ma'aseh listor here means that it does undermine the halachot that were previously mentioned in the Mishnah, because you should here, in this case, have come to a conclusion that either sided with one of the two statements or languages over here. So now it ended up in a case of yechloku. So now Gemara says, chasurei mechsera, that the Mishnah was missing the transition terms between the beginning of the Mishnah and the case. V'achiktani, and this is what it says. V'im amar lo b'shtem asar zuvim l'shana midinar zav l'chodesh, yechloku. So then the Mishnah gives you that halacha. Umasenami, b'tzipori. And then it brings you the case law, which is ve'achad shesachar me'achatz mechaveru b'shtim aser zuim l'shana medina zav l'chodesh uba ma'aseh lifnei rabban shemim gomaliyah v'lifnei rabbi yosi v'amru yachloku et chodesh ha'ibur. They split the chodesh ha'ibur. So all they did is they put in these transition words, which according to Rashi now make it relevant to the Mishnah because the case is mentioned in the Mishnah. Or what the Ramban says, it's no longer a stira because the Mishnah now indicates that there is a third category. It's not simply either you have, they get the Chodesh Ibur belongs to the Socher or it belongs to the Maskir. There is a case where it belongs to both of them. And this Maaseh actually indicates the same. Right, so now the Gemara says, brings three Amoraim's positions as to why the Halacha is as such in our Mishnah. Amarav, Ivai Hatam, if I was the judge in that case, meaning if I was in that case that was brought before Rabban Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Yossi, Havyayinalei Kulei the Maskir, I would have given all the money to the Maskir and the Socher would have to pay for the extra month. Maika Mashmalan, what is Rab teaching us from this? Tfos Lashon Acharon. We go after the latter of your statements. And since the latter of the statement said that it was a Zahav per month, it was one dinar Zahav per month, that means that that's what governs in this situation, Tfos Lashon Acharon. And so Rav is telling us that based on his position, he believes that you go after the latter Lashon. Now Rav generally cannot argue on Tanaim, so then what's going on over here that he's arguing on the Mishnah or Tanaim in our Mishnah? Sometimes the Gemara will say Rav Tanu Palig. The truth is that Rav is really relying on other Mishnayot and Shas. We have the position of Benanas, who says that Tfos Lashon Acharon. And based on that, he's relying on these other Tanaim that believe that Rabban Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Yossi's position here was incorrect because we go by Tfos Lashon Acharon. And that's what Rav is relying on. Rav says, Hamarav Chadazimna. Rav already gave us this information. Why is he telling us again that Tfos Lashon Acharon? Damar Ravuna Amar Bei Rav. So Rav Huna says in the Midrash of Rav, I mean obviously something I'm a sober Rav, Istira me'amoy. Istira generally is a coin that is a shekel or a sela. Ma'e is money, which is generic word. Me'amoy could either be kesef, it could be silver coins, or it could be prutot, which would be copper coins. Rashi notes over here that any time the Gemara is speaking about dinare kesef, it mentions the word kesef. Kesef, unlike the way we use it today, which means generically money, over there when they meant kesef, they meant the silver coin. And that means like a dinar kesef. So Rashi claims that the mo'e over here must be prutot, because it's generic money without the word kesef. That means it's talking about prutot or copper coins. The stira is a shekel or a sela. So now, in terms of the coinage of their time, a sela tsuri, the sela tsuri, which was the base currency or the default currency, the reserve currency of their time, that sela tsuri has 4 dinar in it. But here we're talking about an istira. An istira is not a sela tsuri, but a sela medina. And we learned actually earlier in this masechta, we learned it in the Gemara in Kiddushin as well, that the sela medina is 1/8 of a sela tsuri, which makes it that a sela medina is worth 0.5 dinar. If a sela tsuri is worth 4 dinar, and a sela medina is 1/8 of a sela tsuri, it's a 0.5 dinar kesef. That's what the sela medina is. So now, if you take the translation of those coins, it would turn out that a dinar is worth 6 ma'a kesef. A ma'a kesef is worth 2 pundion, or in essence, a dinar is worth 12 pundion. Each pundion is worth 2 isar, and therefore a dinar is worth 24 isar. Each isar is worth 8 prutot, and therefore 8 times 24 would land you with 192. So that means a dinar equals 192 prutot. So now, a sela medina is worth 0.5 dinar. So half of 192 is 96. So that means that a sela medina is equal to 96 prutot. This individual says, istira me'amoy. You can pay me a sela medina, 100 prutot. So he has a problem in the translation because the natural translation or currency exchange would have been that the sela medina would have been worth 96 prutot. So what does he mean by that? Me'amoy. He means that he's going to get paid 100 prutot. Me'amoy istira. The other hand, if he makes the statement 100 prutot istira, then istira. He means an istira. So now what you see here is tfos lashon acharon. We go by the latter of his statements. So that in the case where he says istira me'amoi, he means 100 prutot. In the case where he says 100 prutot istira, he means istira. Imihotam, if it was from there, havamine perushe kamefarish. The reason that we say tfos lashon acharon is not because of tfos lashon acharon, but rather that he is explaining himself. Not that this is a principle that Rav is laying out, but rather in that case, what Rav believes is that when you say istira me'amoi, you're actually explaining yourself and saying, now the way Rashi explains it is that if you said Sela first, if you said Istira and then Me'amoy, you're saying I want a good Sela Medina, a big one, that's worth 100 prutot. So meaning that you're explaining what type of Istira, what type of Sela Medina that you expect over there, and therefore you get Me'amoy, you get 100 prutot, because the Sela Medina you are explaining through the Me'amoy. In the second statement, where you say Me'amoy Istira, you're saying that I want an Istira, but you can give me these 100 not so good prutot that equal up to a istira. So there you can pay him a regular istira. So what Rashi is suggesting is that perushei kamefaresh means the reason Rav says that the second statement governs is not because the second statement is more important, but simply because the second statement is clarifying what I meant in the first statement. So in the first case, I said a coin, a sela medina, and then I said 100 ma'ot. 100 ma'ot are telling me what type of coin that I want. I want a really big sela medina that equals 100 prutot instead of the 96 standard prutot. In the case where I said 100 prutot, and that's a stira, I'm telling you what type of prutot I want. I want those 100 prutot, which are the weak prutot, that would equal up to a sela medina. And therefore I could explain the whole thing as simply being an explication on the first statement. And that's why he says that the second one governs. But not that in general he would believe Tfos Lashon Acharon. And that's what we come here to clarify and say, Kamash Malan, that Rav holds Tfos Lashon Acharon. That's the reason in the case there. And it's also the reason in our Mishnah that he would believe that Socher pays for the extra month. And it's also the reason why in that case he says that the second language governs. That's the way Rashi reads it. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot note over here that the Perushe Kamefaresh that Rashi explains, we see other places in Shas, whenever you have a stira in the exact amount of the item, that we always go a pachot shebem, we go by the lower of the two numbers that are mentioned. And therefore, the Re explains that had I just had the case by the coins, then in our Mishnah, I would have assumed that it's perushe kamefarish. And that means that kulo lesocher, everything belongs to the socher, and all the maskir is doing is explaining what he means. He says, yes, I'm charging you 12 zuhuvim l'shana, but unlike a typical structure in which you pay all the money at the sof, because ain skirut nishtamelet el basof, over here I'm going to have you pay month by month along the way. And that's what it means, perushe kamefarech. And the other way around, had we had tfos lashon acharon by our Mishnah, then I would have thought by the case of the monies that it's perushe kamefarech, and we would have gone after the pachot shebelashonot. So the way that the Re explains it is, first of all, it's in both directions, that had I only had Rav's statement by our Mishnah, I would have thought Perushe Kamefarish by the coins, and we would have taken the lesser of the two numbers. Or if I only had Rav by the case of the coins, I would have thought in our Mishnah, it's Perushe Kamefarish about how he's going to pay for the yearly amount of 12 Zuhuvim Lishana. The Rashbam brings an alternative view, which is that the Perushe Kamefarish is not going on the monies, but on our Mishnah, unlike Rashi. And he's saying that the double statements are Perushe Kamefarish. And he is saying, if it's a leap year, then it's going to be one zahav per month. If it is a regular year, then it's going to be 12 zuhuvim for the year. And that is the Perushe Kamefarish. Had you not told me Tfos Lashon Acharon, that's how I would have explained our Mishnah. But that makes it that the Perushe Kamefarish, the Gemara here, is different than it's utilized in other places in Shas. And for that reason, that the Balei Tosafot favor the explanation of the Re. Okay, Ushmol Amar, Shmuel says the case in our Mishnah is where he showed up in the middle of the month. That's why Yachloku, they split it. Had he come at the beginning of the month, then it all belongs to the maskir. They came at the end of the month, it all belongs to the renter. So over here, what Shmuel says is that I have competing chazakot. I have the chazakah that the maskir owns the property. He is the landlord. I have a chazakah that the socher is in possession of the money. So depending on which side of the transaction I'm on, one of those two chazakot will govern. If it's prior to the month, then the governing chazakah over here is that the property belongs to the landlord. And therefore, if you want to stay in this property, you're going to have to pay for it. And that's why he believes that if you came at the beginning of the month, the maskir would get everything, or in essence, the maskir would demand payment for the extra month. If, on the other hand, they come after the month, then the socher's already lived there. The only chazakah that is relevant is the fact that he is still in possession of the money. So he has the chezkat ma'ot. So since he has the chezkat ma'ot, if you want to extract the money from him, you got to bring a proof, and therefore it's going to stay with the socher. When you come in the middle of the month, you have exactly half of each. You have the fact that he's already lived there for half the month, where the socher is in possession of the money, and the chezkat of the landlord makes no difference anymore because he already lived there. But for the remainder of the month, the chazakah, or the ownership of the land of the landlord, is relevant. And that's why you split it. So you split it because you have competing chazakot over here. And Shmuel then has a question as to whether we say tfos lashon rishon or tfos lashon acharon. Whether we say that the first language governs or the second language governs. Therefore, whenever you have a safek, what do? You let the chazakot govern. So therefore, in this case, where you have a safek, let's look at the chazakot. And the chazakot land you, depending if you start at the beginning of the month, the end of the month, or the middle of the month, land you with these different outcomes. At the beginning of the month, the chazakah of the maskir governs, and therefore the maskir is entitled. At the end of the month, the chazakah of the socher governs, and therefore he's entitled. In the middle of the month, they are competing chazakot, because half the month was towards the socher, half the month towards the maskir, and therefore yachloku, they split it. Mar says, Mi amar Shmuel, lo amrinan tfos lashon acharon. Is Shmuel really uncertain as to whether we say that the first language or the latter language governs? Va Rav Shmuel d'amrei tarvayu. Don't we have this din from Rav and Shmuel? Kur bishloshim ani mocher lecha. I'm selling you a kur. A kur is a measurement that contains 30 sa'ah in it. And he says, I'm selling it to you for 30. Well, that implies that every sa'ah is worth one. But that wasn't stated explicitly because of the fact that he said kur, which is that larger measurement that has 30 sa'ah in it, I'm selling you the 30 sa'ah with 30 sa'ah. So that sounds like, or implied in that, is sa'ah per sa'ah. But he never says that. Yecholach zorbo, afilu b'sa'ah achrona. You can back out of the transaction until the last sa'ah is measured out. Because you're allowed to back out of a transaction until there's a kinyan mishicha. Until there's a kinyan. The kinyan is not complete until he takes the full 30 sa'ah. Because the price was expressed as a totality, which is full 30 sa'ah for 30 sela. And that means the buyer's acquisition only takes place when he completely gets the 30 sa'ah. Till that point in time, the acquisition's not done. And obviously you'd have to say that this individual needs the money, and therefore he wants to sell the whole thing in one bundle and not piecemeal. And that's why he expressed it as a whole amount rather than a per sa'ah amount. Kor b'shloshim sa'ah b'sela. If he says, I'm selling you a kor, but then he explicates and says that's 30 sa'ah, a sa'ah b'sela, ani morcher lecha, rishon, kana. Then he acquires it one by one. Because in that case, we say that the shloshim sa'ah governs. So now, what you see from that is, tfos lashon acharon. The latter statement governs. Because based on the first statement of kor, then he would not have acquired it until he completed it totally. The reason we say that he gets it sa'ah by sa'ah is because after that he said, sa'ah b'sela. So then the Gemara says, Hotam time am I mishum de tofis. Over there is because he's taking possession of it immediately. Hachanami kotofis. So to over here, he's taking possession of it. So the answer that Shmuel gives is that in the situation of the kor b'shloshim sa'ah, the reasoning is not because of tfos lashon acharon, but rather because you are taking possession of the item. In a safek, possession governs because of chazakot. We just said before that Shmuel says, when I have a safek, I need to look at the chazakot to determine what governs in this case. So in a case where, like this, I don't know. It said kor, it said shloshim sa'ah. Which one of those governs? I don't know. I have a safek. So now, which of those two do I take? Well, let's look at the chazakah. At this point, as you give each sa'ah, who's in possession of that sa'ah? The buyer is already in possession of it. That means that he has the chazak of ownership at this point in time. So now we have a safek as to whether he meant the whole amount as one unit or each unit separately. But he's holding on to the units. At that point, if he wants to back out of it, Well, he can back out of the remaining units that he hasn't given because he's in possession of them, the seller. But the units he's already given to the buyer, the buyer has the chazaka, and therefore it's going to be the obligation of the seller to prove that it really was sold as a totality rather than one by one. So it'll turn out interesting that Rav and Shmuel in that case come to the same conclusion for different reasons. Rav says that the reason that you keep them as you do it one by one is because of Tfos Lashon Acharon, because Rav believes that the latter language governs. On the other hand, Shmuel will say in that case, the reason that you keep it is because it's a safek. I don't know which language governs, and the chazaka governs in that case. So as you give each one, the buyer becomes in possession of them, and that is the chazaka that governs. So too in our case. Shmuel's din is that I have a safek, and therefore the chazaka governs, whoever has possession of it. If the person has yet to live there, then the landlord has possession of it. If he's already lived in there, then the possession is that of the socher, because he's holding the money. And so therefore, you'll split it in the middle, or in the beginning of the month, it'll belong to either party, depending who has the chazaka. Here's the third possibility of explaining our Mishnah. Rav Nachman Amar, karka b'cheskat baleha kayemet. Land belongs to its owner. My kamash malon. What is he teaching us? If the land belongs to the owner, that means that the landlord is the governing party over here. My kamash malon, tfos lashon acharon. What is he teaching us? That latter language governs. Hainu de Rav. That means that it's Rav's position, because he's saying the same thing as Rav. Mar says, no. Apa gav de apa mepach. For Rav Nachman, it doesn't matter which order the language was said. Even it was stated that you're going to pay one zahav per chodesh, 12 zahav for a whole year. Even if you articulate it in that way, Rav Nachman says it belongs to the landlord. Rav in that situation would say that it's for the socher, because the latter language was 12 for the year. And that would be the governing language according to Rav. For Rav Nachman, it has nothing to do with the language or the order of the language. It's simply that the landlord's position or possession governs, because he owns the land. Since he owns the land, he is the one that has the ownership, and it doesn't matter when you come in. As opposed to Shmuel, it says it matters when you come in, because the safek was already extant at the beginning of the month. It's not just because you walk in the middle of the month, oh, the safek starts now. No, the safek started from the beginning of that month. And at the beginning of the month, who has the chazaka? The landlord. And so the landlord always has the upper hand in this case, because he's the one with the chazaka of the property. And if you want to stay in his property, you've got to pay for it if there is a safek. Otherwise, his chazaka will govern and he'll take the property. Once again here, you have Rav Nachman, who disagrees with our Mishnah. Shmuel is the only one who really explains our Mishnah, saying yachloku, that they split it. Rav says, tfos lashon acharon, and that the maskir gets to keep it, because the second piece of their language was that it was a zahav per month, or dina zahav per month. And Rav Nachman says that the landlord gets to keep it because the landlord is the one who has the chazaka, which also is against our Mishnah. So for Rav, we answer that he holds like bananas, like those Tanaim that believe that tfos lashon acharon. And you're going to have to say something similar for Rav Nachman, that our Mishnah is like sumchus, that says mamona mutal b'safek chokim. But he thinks, not like sumchus, like the Rabbonon, that emotzi micharev vero ala v'raya. And therefore the chazaka that governs over here is the chazaka of the property owner, because the whole safek, or when the safek began, that was the key chazaka. It's not when you show up in front of us and ask us about it, but the din itself derives from a point in time where the main chazaka was the chazaka of the landlord. Now the Gemara says, "Boy, mi name me Rabbi Yanai." They asked this question of Rabbi Yanai. Socher amar natati. The socher says, "I paid the rent." Umaskir amar lo natati. The landlord says, I never got the rent. I never took the rent. Ami lavi raya. Upon whom is the burden of proof? Because we always say, emotzi michaveiro, alav haraya. Who is the motzi michaveiro in this case? Emat. The question is, when? Ibit toch zmano tanina. If it's during the rental period, we already have a Mishnah that governs this. Ila achar zmano. If it is after the rental period, tanina, we also have a Mishnah. Ditznan. Because we have a Mishnah in Bichorot. Meita'av. The father passed away, betoch shloshim yom, within 30 days of the birth of his son. This is his oldest child. He passes away before he reaches the 30-day point, which is his pidyon haben. That's the girsa that we have in our Gemara. Though the Gra notes that the Rif, the Rambam, the Rosh, all had a different girsa in our Gemara, and that the shloshim yom that is mentioned here has nothing to do with pidyon haben, but rather has to do with a stam schirut. It has to do with the rental. Obviously, that would make sense in the context of what we're saying. But again, the din turns out to be the same as what we're going to say by Pijona Ben. But just note that they think that this breita was a breita about schirut and not about Pijona Ben. So he passed away. The chazaka is that he did not redeem his child because the general principle is nobody pays before they have to. So over here, he doesn't have to pay the kohen until the 30th day for the pijon. So if he passed away before the 30th day, the assumption is that he did not redeem the child. Unless he brings proof to the fact that you did redeem the child prior to 30 days. You are allowed to do a pijon before 30 days. It's not effective until 30 days. The reason for 30 days is because we want to be certain that he's a bar kayama, that the child is a bar kayama, because there's only a chiyu pijon a ben if it's a bar kayama. So we need 30 days to determine that. If at the 30-day point, he already had redeemed him prior to that point in time, the pijon works, according to Rava, as long as the money is still extant. As long as the money is still there, the pijon is effective on the 30th day when he becomes, or when we know that he is a bar kayama. So if he gave the money early to the kohen, the pijon would be effective on the 30th day if the money's around and the child reaches the 30th day. But people don't pay early. We're going to see in a second the Baal HaTosafot say there's reason for that too, which is that number one, if the kohen spends the money or the money's not there on the 30th day, it's not going to work. And number two is if the child doesn't make it to the 30th day, he doesn't owe the pijon. So there's a big incentive for the person not to pay before the 30th day. So therefore, if he passed away, we assume that he didn't pay for it because there's no reason for him to pay for it early. L'achar shloshim yom, b'cheska shenivdeh. After 30 days, the chazaka is that he paid for it. Ad sheyomru lo shelo nivdeh. Until we have evidence to the contrary that he did not redeem the child. Because we assume that people, when it comes to the due date, do pay at the due date, and they do what's incumbent upon them, which is to redeem their child at the time of the pijon ben. Unless we have evidence to the contrary. Now, evidence to the contrary is not a kohen. Kohen can't come along and say he never redeemed the child. Because this is a class claim and not a personal claim. No particular kohen has a right to make a claim for the pijon. Class of kohenim as a whole have a right to the pijon of ben. So therefore, any person who comes, he can say, I gave it to another kohen. I redeemed it somewhere else. No kohen can come as a representative of the class and say, you didn't pay for it, because he can always say, I gave it to another kohen. Now, obviously, if he says, I gave it to this kohen, and the kohen says, I never got it, then we have to start wondering or have to deal with that issue. But it can't be the claim of the kohen, but rather, as Rashi notes over here, it is the neighbors. The neighbors say that there was never a pijon of ben over here, because a pijon of ben would involve a bracha, a birkat shechiyano, a festive meal. So the neighbor said that they never had, or he never had celebrated a pijon of ben. So Tosfot over here asks from the Gemara in Baba Batra, which we'll get to, it's in the first parak in Baba Batra, that over there there's a machlok demoraim as to whether people pay before the due date. And Abaye there is of the opinion that people do pay off loans before they are due. And that is because people want to get burdens off their back. And when they have outstanding debts, they'd like to remove the debts and not have that burden on them anymore. So according to Abaye, why over here is the Gemara so conclusive that during the 30 days before the pijon ben, that the person definitely didn't pay it? Over here also too, by the rental, why are we certain that he didn't prepay it to get the burden off of his back? So Tosfot says that there's a difference between the case over there, where we're dealing with the discharging of a debt and it's paying off of a debt, versus the cases over here. And that is because in the cases over here, if he prepays for it, he's at risk. Which is that by the pijon ben, if he prepays for the pijon ben, he has risk that either the child will pass away, and he wouldn't have been obligated to pay for the pijon ben, or, as we mentioned before, the possibility that the kohen or the money will not be extant at the 30-day point, and it won't work for pijon ben. So it's too risky for him to prepay the money by the pijon ben and discharge the obligation, because there's uncertainty as to whether the obligation will exist at the 30th day, as well as the fact as to whether he will succeed at discharging the obligation if he prepays it. And then Tosfot goes on to say the big chiddush and say the same thing by rent. If he prepays the rent, he is at risk. Why is he at risk? This is the Tosfot that we quoted yesterday. Is because, Yarei, Lachtim Aschar Peni Pol Abayit. Because maybe the house will fall down, or Yipol Beitosho Maskir. Or the landlord's house will fall down, but Yotzien, and he'll toss him out. So Tosfot over here clearly disagrees with Rashi yesterday, and the Rosh also disagrees with the Baal Yatosfot over here. Baal Yatosfot would say that the landlord has the right to kick out the socher at any time, even if it's under contract, even if he's prepaid for the property, he has the right to kick him out if his house falls down, if the landlord's house falls down. We saw in yesterday's daf that Rashi said that only if the contract had expired, or he's on a month-to-month rental, can he kick him out. But he can't just kick him out if he's in the middle of a lease, or if he prepaid for it. Over here, the Baal Yatosfot say, no, even if you prepaid for it, you can be kicked out. And that's why no renter is going to pay before the end date. Because when he prepays, he has a risk that the rental location will fall down, and then he won't have the rental and he has to get the money back from him. Or that the landlord's house will fall down and he'll kick him out. So therefore, he's not going to prepay because it's too risky. And so that's how Tosafot differentiates between a Abaye's position and Baba Batra, that people like to discharge obligations and pay early, and over here where there are mitigating factors that the person would not want to prepay. And therefore, the Gemara's conclusion over here is that before the due date, nobody pays for a pidyon haben and nobody pays for a rental. Gemara says, look, Tzricha, the case is here, is v'yom d'mishlim z'mane. It was on the due date. So again, prior to the due date, we assume he didn't pay. After the due date, we do assume that he did pay. On the due date, this is where they're arguing. The socher says, I paid it in the morning. The maskir is telling us in the afternoon he never received the money. So on the due date, who has the upper hand in terms of saying whether they did or did not pay? Mi avid inish depara biyoma de mishlam's money. Do people pay right on the due date? Alo, or not? Meaning that on the day that it is due, which is at the end, remember that schirut, or these things are only due at the last minute of that day. So when on the due date, do they pay early in the day on the due date? Or do they pay right after they cross over that threshold of the due date, then they pay it? So that's the question at hand. So Amarlo Rabbi Yona Chanan Tiritua. That's also a Mishnah, which is Sakhir Bizmano Nishba Vinotel. It's a Mishnah in Shvuot. The Mishnah in Shvuot tells us that Shvuot de Oraita, Shvuot min Torah, are a Shvuot that make you patur. If you take a Shvuot, you don't have to pay. The Mishnayot in Shvuot tell us about certain Shvuot that the Rabbanan instituted, where it's a Nishba Vinotel. He has a right to take a Shvuah and to collect. Again, that's obviously a Shvuah de Rabbanan, because Shvuah de Oraita are always to make you patur. Here you take a Shvuah and collecting based on that Shvuah. So there's certain Shvuot where the Chachamim instituted that you have a right to take a Shvuah and collect. One of those is Sakhir, a wage earner, someone who is a laborer that collects wages from the Baal HaBayit. So on the due date, if he comes and says he did not get paid, the Baal HaBayit says he did pay, we allow the employee to take a Shvuah and collect his money. Now, obviously, if it's before the due date, we don't assume that the owner paid. And if it's after the due date, the Sakhir doesn't have a right to make a claim anymore, because we assume that the owner paid him, or the employer paid him at that point. But on his due date, if he shows up and says, I didn't get paid, he takes a Shvuah and hotel. Why? Sakhir u d'ramu rabbanan shvuah alei. By a sakhir, by an employee, the Rabbanan handed the Shvuah over to the employee. Instead of having the employer take the Shvuah and be patur, we hand it over to the employee and allow him to take the Shvuah and collect. Bishum the Baal HaBayit tarud bepo'alav. Because the Baal HaBayit, the employer, is preoccupied. He has many things that he's dealing with. He's dealing with many employees, as well as other expenses, other issues that are going on. So in his mind, he could make a mistake and think that he paid this employee even though he didn't. This employee only has one thing to worry about, his own payment. And therefore, we rely on him through a Shvuah to take a Shvuah. Aval hocha, socher mehemen bishvuah. Over here, the socher has a right to take a Shvuah and to release himself from the obligation. Because over here, the socher only has one thing to deal with. That is the rental that he had to pay for. And therefore, the socher should have a right to take a Shvuah and dismiss the case. So here, and when they have an argument, the socher has a right to take a Shvuah and be patur. The Shvuah that he's taking over here is a Shvat Haseit. Shvat Haseit is also a Shvuah de Rabbanan. That was a later institution put in place by the time of Rabbi Nachman, where someone was kofer bakol. Shervina Torah, you only have to take a Shvuah via Modeh ben Miktzat. But over here, he's kofer bakol. He's denying that he owes any of the rental income. He takes a Shvat Haseit, and then he is patur. The socher is given the right to take the Shvuah, not the maskir in this case, on the due date. On the due date, where they both have a certain amount of chazakah here, we hand it over to the socher to take the Shvuah, be patur like normal Shvuot de Oraita, even though it's only a Shvuah de Rabbanan, It's patterned after the Shavuot Doraita. In the case of an employee, where there's a mitigating factor, the Rabbanan flipped the Shavuot onto the claimant instead of on the defendant. But that means or implies that only in the case of an employee is it that way. But in the case of a renter, then the Shavuot would stay with the renter and he takes the Shavuot Taseit and would be patur. Okay, we're going to stop here, four lines down on the top of Kuf Gimel Amud Aleph.